Most of my life, I've had a fascination with emergency preparedness. I got involved with civil defense as a child. My scoutmaster was really big on it, so they used to do a lot of mobilization drills and search and rescue things, and it was all, you know, simple things at the kid level. And then from there, I got involved in the Bridgeview Civil Defense Organization as a teenager, and just continued on as emergency services disaster agencies formed in the communities I moved to. And today I'm with Tinley Park Emergency Management Agency. I also run the Skywarn operations for northeastern Illinois and northwestern Indiana and work directly with the National Weather Service. I'm a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security. I've been with the FBI InfraGuard program doing national infrastructure protection for about 25 years now, and that's just what I do for fun. So in any case, I've spent most of the last couple decades teaching emergency preparedness to the public in different groups. I was actually a Red Cross first aid instructor for about 16 years. So it's just been kind of part of my life. What are individuals with special needs? You know, obviously those of us that are visually impaired, people that have auditory impairments, physical or cognitive challenges, babies, elderly, those with special medical needs, and those on life support. So those categories, and I'm going to speak not only to the blind and visually impaired, but to disabilities in general, since some of us have more than one disability. So here's a scenario for you. I met a young lady yesterday, her name is Anne, and she kind of caused me to think of this scenario. She's blind and deaf, and so here's the scenario. You're blind and deaf, your silent call starts to vibrate. When you answer it, a family member tells you that there's a multi-state supercell produces spawning tornadoes, and you have 20 minutes to leave where you're at and go to shelter. So the question I have for everybody here is, do you know where you're going to go, and do you know how you're going to get there? So those are a couple of the challenging scenarios that we can face. Are you ready? So what are our objectives today? We're going to learn about the benefits of being prepared. We're going to identify the hazards that you might face in your home, your work, school, or your vacation, or anywhere else you might be. We're going to identify what the greatest challenges are for people with visual disabilities. We're going to recognize the importance of making a disaster plan for our families, develop a family disaster plan, and modify your plan to accommodate those with special needs. We'll create a communications plan, which is really important, and we'll talk about that in a lot of depth, because that's one of the more important elements here. It's planning our escape routes. How are you going to get out of the building you're in, and how are you going to get out of the community you're in if you have to go somewhere farther away? Making an emergency kit for home, for school, for work, for vacation, wherever you might be. Identify the steps to take after a disaster. So those are the things we're going to talk about. So what are the benefits of being prepared? Why do you care? You know, a lot of people just stick their head in the sand, like my 24-year-old son. He doesn't want to know anything about this stuff. He just figures, well, whatever happens, happens. So he's part of the you know how he had the Generation X and Generation Y. He's part of Generation Y. Why should I do that? Why does that matter? So it makes you a survivor, not a victim. How many of us want to be survivors if we have a disaster by yelling out yes or whatever? So we all want to be a survivor. None of us want to be a victim. In fact, the National Federation of Blind teaches us all to be survivors. So it reduces fear and anxiety if you're prepared and understand the disasters, and that's really important, because if we can't see the situation we're in, it does dramatically raise our anxiety and our fear. There's a great book I started reading last night called The Science of Fear by Bob Gardner. I'd highly recommend you pick it up and read it. It's a really neat book. Certainly, we reduce the impact of disasters that they have on us and our families. If we're prepared and understand the scenarios when they do occur, we'll be mentally ready to challenge them head on. Communications communities, families, and individuals will actually know what to do when a disaster occurs if you're prepared for a disaster. So what hazards might you face? Most of these are common. Most of these you know. I'm going to read them really fast. Thunderstorms, lightning, tornado, winds, floods, fires and wildfires, heat waves, droughts, extreme cold, winter storms, ice storms, blizzards, earthquakes. I'm going to pause at earthquakes a second. We all know about the Madrid Fault. Well, the Madrid Fault has been much more active lately, and there's been quite a few tremors on it, and it's expected that sometime in the next few years it may produce an 8 or a 9. And if that does occur, not only will we feel it here, but we could even have some minor damage to buildings. Chemical spills or gases that are leaked in the air, explosions, blackouts, solar storms. Everybody may not know we're in solar cycle 24 now, but solar cycle 24 has produced a lot of CMEs, or coronal mass ejections from the sun, and this produces a lot of gamma and X-ray radiation. And the last two we had in the last few weeks were basically what's called an X2. And back in 1989, when about a third of Canada went black, they had an X30, which produces just huge amounts of energies that come from the sun. The first round of gamma radiation hits the Earth in about 8 minutes, and the X-ray radiation may take up to 72 or 96 hours, but it will disrupt communication satellites, navigation systems, GPS. If it's something like an X30, it could shut down our power grid and actually destroy transformers. There's 42 transformers in the Midwest power grid. There's 6 spares in the entire country. Need I say more? Okay, so right now they're predicting solar storms to be pretty active in April of 2012 and possibly in the latter part of December of this year. So that's something to think about. Terrorism, terrorism's all about instilling fear in people, so and making it so you're uncomfortable with your day-to-day life. So we need to just be aware of the fact that, although terrorism's there, it's really not going to likely cross most of our paths. War. Biological hazards, nuclear hazards, radiological, civil emergencies, transportation accidents, other types of accidents, mudslides, which I've personally experienced with a friend of mine in Mexico, which was pretty scary, hurricanes, tsunamis, and last but not least, volcanoes. So, yeah, some of those aren't going to happen here. We're not likely to see a tsunami in Chicago unless Lake Michigan gets really stirred up. But that's not going to happen in our lifetimes. So here's a simple model to think about. The first aspect is, you as an individual, what capabilities do you have? What limitations do you have? What do you need to be prepared to survive an event? The next aspect is you and your environment. Do you understand your environment so that you can safely leave it should the building become damaged, or should you be trapped? Do you have enough to survive in place? Do you know how to walk the streets or find transportation around the area where you happen to be at? And the last element is you and your community. And I'm actually going to try to start up some activities in the NFB surrounding this. It's going to be vital for us to reach out to all the various organizations and try to make disaster planning resources available in alternative mediums. I talked to my FEMA counterpart in the warehouse that distributes all the materials, and Don told me that they have nothing in Braille, nothing in audio, and nothing in large print. I'm like, well, we're going to have a discussion about that, Don. So we may be reaching out to you to sign a petition on that topic. So what are the greatest challenges that blind people face during an emergency? Well, awareness is probably the first and biggest one, because if you might not even know an emergency or disaster or some event is happening around you. So you need to figure out how you're going to successfully become aware of emergencies. And I'll talk about these things in more detail. I'm going to casually mention them first. Transportation is a big one. None of us can load our trunk up with goods and jump in the car and drive to another city in order to avoid some event that might threaten our path, or in order to go somewhere safe when we're told ahead of time. Communications is a big one. We don't have the ability to necessarily read print or reach out on a variety of different communications mediums, so it's important to come up with some strategies there. Support is critical. You know, establishing a buddy system, becoming friends with your neighbors, having people you can talk to when a situation arises is very critical. So you can check on them and they can check on you, and you can make sure everybody's safe. Your path may be blocked. Sidewalks could be uplifted in an earthquake, and you might not be able to walk on a street or a sidewalk. So how are you going to get past those particular scenarios? Your home might become damaged and you might have to leave your home. Your usual way of getting food may be disturbed, and you might have to figure out how you're going to get food or medicine or any number of other things. You may not be able to carry out all the things you need. So you may be stuck with a cart you can pull or a backpack you can wear with whatever you can bring with you. And your daily living activities could very well be disrupted as well. Utilities will likely be disrupted in many scenarios. Gas, electric, and water could be a factor. You should learn how to turn those services off, and with one caveat, if you turn gas off, it has to be turned back on by a professional, because you risk damaging your household appliances or causing an explosion or a fire. With respect to water, if there's water contamination and you can shut your water off in time, you might be able to use the water in, say, a bathtub you fill up, or a hot water heater, or the water that's in your pipes if you don't have any other source of water. And we'll talk about some sources of water in a little bit as well. Let's see here. Familiar landmarks may be gone. If there was a building that maybe played music out their speakers, a restaurant or something that was a good landmark for you, there may have been a pillar you know is there, or some other type of markings on the street. If those things are gone, you may not be able to use those as navigational tools. Limitations on what you can bring with you is a big factor. I'm mentioning that a second time because it's quite important. So you need to be able to care for yourself and care for your family members, and it may be more challenging if you're not in a place you're familiar with. If you have children, you could even get separated. And if you get separated, that can be scary. If you're at home or work and your children are at school and a disaster happens, and let's say that we did an earthquake drill back in May, and the simulation was that 26 bridges collapsed in the Illinois, and it made a lot of people trapped in certain sections of the state, and it made it difficult for commerce and transportation, so people couldn't get food supplies and medicine to hospitals. Having sufficient financial resources to afford what you might want to have for your emergency kit can be a challenge for many of us, because many might not have very high incomes or extra money. All right, so what should a family disaster plan consist of? How am I doing on time, David? I think I can do that. Let's see. Knowing the protective measures for specific hazards is important, and we're not going to go into that today because it's about an eight-hour course if you want the whole thing. Someday, if you want, I'll come down on a Saturday and do a full eight-hour thing for you. Assessing your needs, find out what you personally need or your family members need. Recognizing warning systems and signals. Well, you need to find out, this is going back to the awareness topic, you need to be able to become aware of incidents that are occurring. You can get a weather radio that's a full alert radio that will actually tell you all the different emergencies that are going on. I have not found one that's accessible yet, so the best you can probably hope for is when an event is read over the air, you can just push the button on the radio and listen to what it is, or it'll turn on automatically. There's sirens in all of our communities. Those are intended for outside people, not inside your home. So the sirens aren't necessarily loud enough for everybody to hear in the house, but they're to warn people that are on the outside to seek shelter. There's the EAS, Emergency Activation System, which is on all televisions and radios. If you are deaf, most of them are captioned as well, so that can be beneficial. Let's see. Evacuation from the disaster area versus sheltering in place. Now, there may be many emergencies where you want to just shelter in place because you don't have to leave the area where you're at. So if it's a tornado, for example, you might shelter in place in a basement or on an inside room, or like a bathroom oftentimes will be in the center of in the house to protect you. It's no longer really a good practice to open your windows. It doesn't really solve any problems. In fact, it could cause your house to explode even more than if the windows were closed. So it's actually better to leave them closed. If you have to evacuate, it's going to be critical that you have a network of friends that you can work with, ideally even some sighted friends if possible. Knowing your environment, knowing how to get out of a building you're in. If you're staying in a place like a friend's house that's new to you, or a hotel or anything, learn where the emergency exits are. Learn at least two ways to leave a room and learn at least two ways to leave a building. Incorporating any plans that your community, school, or work might have into your plan is important. So if you've got a child in school, find out what the school's disaster plan is. Learn what protocols you have to follow to pick the child up after you get a clearance when the disaster is over. A lot of times if you can't pick your child up, they may not allow somebody else to pick the child up unless they're on your child's release form. So that's an important thing. I highly recommend every child has a secret code, and they can keep that secret code either inside of a bracelet or around their neck. And if somebody needs to communicate with you by phone or wants to help your child, if they don't know the secret code, then your child knows it's not a good person to go with. So that's kind of a clever thing to keep in mind. Identify transit transportation and pedestrian escape routes. So there are tactile maps, there are braille guides that you can get. Try to put together what you need so you can successfully leave any area if you have to by any means necessary. Establishing and testing your family plan. So if you put a plan together but don't practice it and reevaluate it periodically, it's not a very good plan. So I've actually taken my grandkids and let them climb out my escape ladder from the second floor bedroom just so they could have the experience. And of course, they thought it was cool. They didn't know why they were doing it, but, you know. Shutting off utilities. Again, I mentioned this a second time. You need to know how to shut them off. You can get a long metal wrench that also serves with as a crowbar, so you can help, you know, if you get trapped or someone else is trapped, you can use it as a tool to help remove debris. Obtaining appropriate insurance. You may need flood insurance, and some people don't even realize they're in a flood area. And if bad floods occur, I was in a 500-year floodplain in Mount Prospect when the Des Plaines River went off in the late 80s and had 6 feet of water in my basement, and I lost a lot of stuff. But it's, you know, you need to plan for those types of things. And you know, if you're in any kind of a floodplain at all, it may just be your luck that it's going to flood that particular time. Establish a buddy system. I'm really big on buddy systems. If if you know somebody that's always going to be around you during different places you're at, try to make buddies with them, not just friends, but actual buddies that will work together in the event of a disaster and that will practice with you evacuation techniques and things like that. Preparing for special needs. You know, if you have specific mobility challenges like using crutches or wheelchairs or things like that, you need to figure out, you know, what happens if my crutch breaks? What happens if my wheelchair can't navigate debris? You know, how am I going to successfully get where I have to go? Caring for animals is also important. Most shelters won't allow animals, but will in fact allow guide dogs. And I thought this was kind of funny. They also talked about monkeys, and apparently you can get a care monkey that can help take care of you. So that was kind of interesting. So I'll have to read more about that one, because that's kind of clever. Learning safety and survival skills is particularly important. So does your community school or work have a disaster plan? So talk to your Department of Transportation, talk to IDOT, and find out what provisions they have to help you deal with disasters in your particular area. What does their plan contain? The community, the school, the work, whatever. You know, find out how they accommodate people with disabilities. How often is it reviewed and updated? What should I know about the plan? You know, so make an effort to learn about what's going on in the environment you happen to be in. What hazards does it cover? Because not all emergency plans will cover an earthquake in the Midwest, because they don't think one's going to happen anytime soon. So it's important to understand what they don't cover. Contact your police, fire, or emergency transportation agency and learn from them how they're dealing with it. Tinley Park has a nice program where you can register and tell them what your special medical needs are, or if you have any disabilities, and that way they know to pay attention to you early on in the disaster, so that way you can get the help you need. That does create some privacy issues for some of us, so you have to consider that. Contact your local service agencies, could be Red Cross, Salvation Army, or any others, and find out what resources they offer in times of an emergency. Demand pre-emergency planning documents in accessible formats. I'm mentioning that a second time now, too. So when they're reading bulletins over the television, that's great for people that, you know, don't have the ability to see the TV, but a lot of times they'll scroll things on the screen and not read them. So we have to reach out to our local media and make sure anything they scroll is read slowly and repeatedly, so that way we can all be aware of what's going on. Work with your neighbors to establish a neighborhood evacuation plan. So that way if you have to evacuate, the neighborhood can work as a team. In fact, speaking of which, we have a thing called the Community Emergency Response Team, and the CERT is something every one of us should and can join, and this provides a mechanism for us to help each other in the time of an emergency before resources arrive on scene to help us. Because it could be 2 or 3 days or longer before help actually arrives, so you may have to be sufficiently self-sufficient. In fact, in some cases, you might have to be self-sufficient longer, but we won't go into that right now. That's all political stuff. Call the Red Cross and other support organizations to identify resources and training opportunities. The Red Cross has a lot of classes that they teach that are pretty good, although from when I taught them till now, they've gotten pretty lame in terms of what they're willing to cover because of liability stuff. But there's CPR courses you can take, and these are things you need to renew every couple of years to make sure your knowledge stays current. Reach out to local media and ensure... Oh, wait a second. This is goofy here. Let's see. Reach out to local media to ensure that emergency... Oh. Okay. I already mentioned that point, so that was it. Actually,
sure.
Yeah, right. I'll jump down here. So make sure that EMA, Red Cross, and other local agencies maintain and use practices that enable those with visual disabilities or other impairments. So a lot of times emergency management agencies, fire departments, and others have not experienced dealing with emergencies with people with challenges. And so it's important to go visit your fire department, your police department, and help them understand what blindness means and help them understand the kinds of assistance we might need in a disaster. So we're almost done there. Elements to make a family communications plan. So in an emergency, the local phone service may be inaccessible. However, you might be able to make a long-distance phone call. So it's good to have an out-of-state emergency contact because you're more likely to be able to make an out-of-state call than an in-state call. So if all your family members know to call one out-of-state person, you now have a communications vehicle. Emergency phone numbers, have them in Braille and print. Vital information for each family member should be carried in Braille and print. Have a means of taking notes. Have your stylus and your slate so you can write notes if you need to make note of things. Create phrase cards. There's times when we might not be able to speak because we're under so much stress, and a note card that we can pull out and show somebody may be suitable to help communicate something. How will you communicate? Well, if the cell phone network is jammed and the telephone network is jammed, you might not be able to make a voice call, but you might be able to use messaging, because messaging will get through with lower bandwidth, so that could be important. So learn how to use SMS. You might consider getting an amateur radio license or possibly getting some family band or other types of little handheld radios that are very inexpensive. You can get a pair of them for $18. A phone card is good to have. Some loose change is good to have in case you have to make an emergency call, and we're lucky enough to be able to have phone systems to even make calls on. Adaptive communications devices, say TTYs or Braille TTYs or other things you might need. Plan where to go and where you're going to meet people in an emergency. Now, that doesn't really sound like a communication step, but in fact it is, because you're communicating where you're going to meet at. Additional information, things you might want to make note of to carry with you. There's a lot of alert services you can subscribe to that'll send messages to a pager, to a cell phone. So those are good things to get into, and I can provide that information to anybody that wants them. How are you going to power your battery-operated devices in an emergency? You may have to, your cell phone might die in a day. So one of the things I teach people is turn your cell phone off and turn it on every half hour to an hour for a few minutes, and let everybody know in your communication plan that that's your objective, is you want to, try to conserve your power. Alternatively, and additionally, you can add a hand crank generator, which you can get for $30, $40. They're really tiny. They're maybe about an inch and a half square. And you can use that to power your various devices. Emergency phone number list. I think I mentioned that, but I'll mention it a second time. 911. Do not call 911 unless you really have an emergency. The phone systems are already going to be jammed up. And if you call to ask what's going on, then people that really need help can't get it. Let's see. Do not get rid of your TTY or Braille TTY. They can save you in the event of this situation. Don't assume the internet's going to work. Don't assume you have email and all those other things we're used to today. Learn to go down to the basics. I have a scrub board at home, so if I have no electricity, I can still wash my clothes. Create a support network. Again, that's a concept I'll reinforce. Get to know your neighbors. Now, your community, and again, I'll mention this a second time, may have a registration system where you can register so they know you're out there. If you have diabetes and on our type 1, you may critically need that to get medication. Have your neighbors check on you and you check on them. If you have to leave your house, and this is kind of a catch-22, you need to leave a note somewhere so people know where you've gone. Now, the downside of putting a note on your door saying, I've left and I'm here, is bad, because then the burglars are going to know, hey, we can go in there, nobody's there, we'll just take all their stuff. Service animals. Human shelters do not allow animals. However, by federal law, they have to allow service animals.
Even that service monkey.
Even the service monkey, that's right. Your service animal may be injured during a disaster. You need to consider how you're going to care for your service animal and how you're going to get along without the service animal. So if you choose not to use a cane and you're using a service animal, it's good to have that cane backup plan. You need to have an emergency kit for your guide dog. You know, you should have water, food, medication, whatever you need to care for your guide dog. Ensure that your guide dog has proper fitting collar with proper identification. That's really important because if you need to prove it's a guide dog, which you will have to do in a disaster scenario, you may have to present papers or show his collar and ID. Ensure the guide dog shots are current. Carry up-to-date medical records on your dog. Develop the confidence to survive. Have an emergency kit, know how to use it, get training, work on your mental and physical preparedness. It's really important that you're comfortable with that. Here are seven key skills to survival. Knowing how to find water and how to purify it, knowing how to start a fire, knowing how to find or make a shelter, signaling and communications, food gathering, first aid, and direction finding. Now, some of those will be more challenging for us than others, but those are some of the key things for survival. What should you have in your basic emergency kit? We're on our last page of the slides here. 1 gallon of water per person per day. Water is the most important thing we need to live. We can live without food, but we'll die without water. Enough non-perishable food for at least 3 days. I recommend probably closer to 5. Prescriptions and assistive devices. I keep 2 weeks of medicine in my 72-hour kit, and I keep a spare cane, and I keep a spare pair of sunglasses. A cane is, of course, important to have a backup for in case you break a cane. Work gloves and sturdy shoes. Why? We depend on our sense of touch, and in a disaster, there could be broken pieces of glass or metal or any number of things that we have to traverse. So it's important we protect our feet and protect our hands. It's also important to consider a dust mask, like a 3M N95 mask, a pair of goggles to protect your eyes. If you have low vision, even if you don't, it's good to protect your face in some respect. Then optionally a hard hat, a battery or crank-operated radio. I actually brought an example of one that runs on solar battery or hand crank. I can pass it around. Flashlights with a spare battery. Okay, you're totally blind. Why the hell do you need a flashlight? But what if somebody else needs a flashlight to help you and it's totally dark and there's nothing around? It could save your life.
It could be a signal for them to find you.
It could be a signal for them to find you. I recommend everybody that doesn't have one get a whistle and carry it in your pocket or attach it to your cane. Consider getting either a Braille compass or a digital compass. The Braille compass is better in my mind because it doesn't depend on batteries. Signaling mirror can be useful also. I carry all those things in my jacket pocket in the wintertime or in my pouch that I wear most of the other times of the year. Personal first aid kit is good to have. It doesn't need to be for anybody but you. Documentation and personal identification. Make a copy of your bank account, your insurance, your proof of mortgage, or wherever you live. You might have to prove who you are to go back into your house. Change of clothing is always good, and extra socks. Why? Well, the Army Rangers had a good saying, if you take care of your feet will take care of you. A poncho or raincoat, toiletries, and personal hygiene items. Any questions?
I actually have a question for you, Greg.
Okay.
When we go to these conventions, I notice by the elevator they have a sign that says, in case of an emergency, do not use the elevator but use the stairs.
Where are the
stairs? My next question is, where are the stairs?
By the elevator.
Well, in general, in most buildings, they'll either be in close proximity to the elevator, but sometimes they may be across the floor from the elevator. Sometimes they have them behind hidden walls in a lot of the corporate buildings that you just have to know to push on. So the answer to that question is learn your environment. Go ask somebody to show you where those things are at.
When you check in at the front desk, they will tell you.
Absolutely. The front desk can tell you, guest services. I have a complete emergency list, which I'll post on the list, sir. Post on the listserv so everybody can get it. I also have a really good first aid kit list if you want to build a comprehensive family first aid kit.
Oh, this was excellent.
Absolutely.
Can I have the mic? This is it.
You had sent you two buttons on a volume control and might be able to memorize which is which.
Dave, just a quick thing that I wanted to mention. I think it's very, it's a great thing we had emergency preparedness today because it kind of winds into a fact that maybe a lot of us don't know. Today is National White Cane Safety Day.
Oh, wow.
You know, by golly, Pam might actually forgotten about that myself. But
I know.
National White Cane Safety Day, thank you very much, Greg, for your presentation on emergency preparedness. We look forward to whatever you can provide on that list, and we would hope that you'll be able to be a resource for those of us who might have questions outside of this meeting.
I get the mic back, Gina.
Again.
Sure.
Okay, next item on the agenda is...
Actually, Dave, let me sneak in there before you go there. My phone number is very accessible. My email is very accessible. If anybody has questions, feel free. I think it would be fun to consider creating an emergency preparedness division for the NFB and work on making things accessible to us for pre-emergency preparedness.
Great idea.
708-267-6664. It's on all my emails that I post on Hill Talk.
Mr. Chairman, okay, I have just a quick question. Because, you know, there's some people in here that don't have email. Is there a way that perhaps we could make this available to people, you know, in Braille or something for those who don't have email? Let's not forget people, but everybody has email.
Is there a way to put
it in there? Yeah, to answer that question, yes, because HAP has made an audio recording of this presentation, so that'll be accessible. I will make an audio recording of the emergency preparedness checklist that I have, and I will post those. It'll give me a couple of weeks to do that, but I'm actually trying to learn enough Braille that I can eventually get to the point of being a transcriber, because that way I can start, you know, publishing some of this stuff myself as well.